Welcome to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We are very, very fortunate to have the co-authors of what is, I think, going to be the number one best-selling book in America in the next couple of days. I Alone Can Fix It, Donald J. Trump's Catastrophic Final Year. Carol Lenig and Philip Rucker, both Pulitzer Prize winners, join me on the podcast today. Carol, Phil, thank you for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Charlie. It's great to be here with you.
It's our pleasure.
I just want to say just up front for people who are thinking, well, I've read a lot of excerpts of the book and I lived through that catastrophic year, so I don't necessarily need to read the book. No, you do actually need to read the book. This is one of those moments, and I want to ask you about this a little bit later. You know, we've lived this, we think that we know it, but there's so much going on. It happens so fast. Putting it into context, getting the texture of the moments in the interplay is extraordinarily interesting. And this last year, I don't know how you feel about it, but I you know, up until now, I thought of, you know, sort of 1968 as being the iconic year when everything happened, this extraordinary moment where all the planets collided. I think 2020 is going to be remembered the same way. Do you agree, Carol?
You know, I do think it is what compelled Phil and I, after being exhausted writing the first book about Trump's presidency.
A Very Stable Genius, also a bestseller.
You know, we did not intend to come back and write another book because we felt like we really captured what motivated the man and the chaotic elements of his impulses and the danger to the country. But 2020 turned out to be, you know, one for the record books, one for the epic books. And we felt really like it would be malpractice in our world not to, as you say, come back, look deeper, and make sense of it. Now, there are a ton of revelations in this book that gobsmacked Phil and me when we sat down for these interviews with people. When they told us what they experienced in real time, we were just amazed. You know, things like learning that Donald Trump was really happy as he watched the television on January 6th, learning that he was fine with the crimes that were literally being committed, which is trespassing on federal property and starting a riot on a Capitol ground. And we learned he was also absolutely dismissive of the danger to Americans and their health. He was focused exclusively over and over again on, you know, keeping the COVID numbers down, even if it meant keeping Americans at sea in China and not bringing them back from Wuhan. He was fine with Americans being in danger across the country, as long as he could keep spilling and spreading this happy talk that the virus really wasn't that serious.
So, Phil, this is actually the first question that I was going to ask you, was you have lived covering Donald Trump for the last 4 or 5 years. You've written a definitive book about Donald Trump, you know, A Very Stable Genius. So that was my question is, were there any surprises, you know, as you wrote this book, as somebody that has lived and breathed the Trump presidency, what were for you the biggest surprises? And Carol's mentioned a few.
Yeah, you know, what surprised me the most, and you're right about living and breathing it. I, you know, was in so many of those press conferences and traveling around the world with him and felt like we had a front row seat to what was happening. And yet when Carol and I did this deeper excavation after he left office and sat down for hours at a time with cabinet members and some of his senior most advisors to peel back the curtain, we realized things were so much worse than we even knew in the moment. I mean, they're as bad as we imagined. The degree to which the president had to be restrained by his advisors, the degree to which the leaders of the military feared a coup, the extent to which the president was willing to demean and malign and discredit government scientists and medical experts and the people on the front lines actually trying to rescue this country from a pandemic. It was startling and jaw-dropping to hear the anecdotes of what was really happening in the Oval Office and behind the scenes, even for us. And we thought we knew it all. I mean, we had been frontline reporters reporters living it and breathing it, and yet it was so much worse.
And that's the experience of reading the book as well. Obviously, you know, we've written and talked about this on a daily basis, but the details are truly extraordinary. One of the things that I think is really, you know, fascinating is the fact that Donald Trump agreed to talk with you, and that you and Carol went down to Mar-a-Lago, and you spent more than 2 hours sitting in the lobby of his club, talking with him, and asked him about. I want to play this because you asked him about January 6th and his thoughts about the election, and this is worth listening to. It runs about 4 minutes, but it really gives you a sense of what the former president of the United States, what, you know, how his mind works, what he thinks about it, and the stories he continues to tell himself and others. So this is from your interview, which you posted on the Washington Post website today.
What did you hope they would do when you said, go up there and stop the
storm? Well, I heard that people wanted to go down to, you know, that wasn't my rally per se. That was, there were a lot of people that spoke.
Yeah.
They had rallies the night before. They had speakers all over the city. You had hundreds of thousands of people. I would venture to say, I think it was the largest crowd I've ever spoken before. It went from that point, which is almost at the White House, to beyond the Washington Monument. It was, and wide. And
but if you could have waited.
And it was a loving crowd, too, by the way. There was a lot of love. I've heard that from everybody. Many, many people have told me. That was a loving crowd. And, you know, it was too bad. It was too bad that got, you know, that they did that.
There were just some...
From my statement.
Mr. President, I apologize. What we're trying to understand is... Not blame, not castigate.
No,
we want to understand, what did you want when you said, go up there? What would you have dreamed?
I would have said that you will show not to go in, although they were ushered in by the police. I mean, in all fairness, the Capitol Police were ushering people in. The Capitol Police were very friendly. You know, they were hugging the kids. You don't see that. But there's plenty
places.
Of tape on that, too,
in
you know, because the Capitol Police were, that's the way it is. But I wanted, I mean, personally, what I wanted is what they wanted. They showed up just to show support, because I happen to believe the election was rigged at a level like nothing has ever been rigged before. There's tremendous proof. Statistically, it wasn't even possible that he won. I mean, things such as if you win Florida and Ohio and Iowa, there's never been a loss. There was a
loss. And did you need better lawyers? Because they took it to court, but they didn't
give
enough evidence
to convince
the judges.
I needed better judges. The Supreme Court was afraid to take it. Don't forget, if you take all of the everything out, take all of the dead people that voted, and there were thousands of them, by the way. We have lists of, you know, obituaries, etc. If you take the illegal immigrants that voted, if you take this, the Indians that got paid to vote in different places, you know, we had Indians getting paid to vote, many, many different things. All election changing, not just, you know, 12 people. I mean, all, because they were all very close, you know, the five, it's only in five places. If you take that, forget all of that. It's massive numbers, but forget all of that. If you take all of that, just look at one thing. The legislatures of the states did not approve all of the things that were done for those elections. And under the Constitution of the United States, they have to do that. And the Supreme Court, they didn't find fact. Don't forget, they didn't say, well, we disagree. They said, we're not going to hear the case. I'm very disappointed in the Supreme Court.
What do you think they were afraid of?
I guess they thought that it would be violent, maybe. And it was violent the other way, perhaps. I don't know. But I guess they thought that it would be violent. But the Supreme Court of the United States, in the Constitution, it says you can't have local politicians setting the rules. And they set the rules. Early voting, this voting, ballots, many, many different things. And these were Democrats going to Republican, with the exception of Nevada, which was a Democrat legislature. And by the way, they didn't even, they did for the most part approve, but they had things that they didn't approve. But the other ones had very little done, almost nothing. So they were setting illegally all of these rules, regulations, everything. Poll watchers who were absolutely brutalized and thrown out. We had no poll watchers allowed in buildings for days. Okay. It was an illegal, corrupt election, as bad as a third world country. Okay. So with that, the judges just would not, they would not rule. We had...
Well, can I, one more beat on that? If you had bad judges, that's like 86 bad judges. Were they afraid? Were they, some of them were people you appointed.
No, that's true. I'm not saying, I appointed them and I was very disappointed in them.
So there he was. He was very disappointed by the judges. You were on CNN yesterday, and Anderson Cooper said this was like listening to drunk Nixon, just going and spinning his story. So, Carol, I guess, what was your reaction as you're sitting there watching Donald Trump tell, you know, spin this you know, this web of Trumpian, you know, sort of lies about the election and his spin on January 6th. What was your reaction talking to him, hearing this?
There were times then it was very difficult for Phil and for me to kind of keep a straight poker face. You know, we wanted desperately to hear his version of events. We had no idea how invested he was in a kind of delusional alternate reality. And I will say one thing that is kind of is amazing to me as an investigative reporter is I feel like you can always tell when you're sitting down for an interview, the things that people know that they're kind of fudging and stretching, there are little physical tells. And it's part of what makes it important to be an investigative reporter is to detect that. Donald Trump, from his stem to his stern, from his nose to his toes, is completely committed to these series of lies. His physicality tells you, this snake oil is a miracle drug. This lie I am telling you, the election was rigged. As he said, Indians were paid to vote. And that is part of the reason I unfairly was robbed of my victory. Dead people voted. He says these things with such commitment. I don't know that
is commitment the same as belief. Okay, he's committed to selling the con, but does he believe it himself?
You know, Charlie, I've got to tell you, it is amazing because the degree to which he can sell it, I think, must answer the question of why he is such an excellent campaigner. But even his inside aides, even his most ardent supporters inside the White House and in his cabinet, they don't even know for sure whether he believes it, has been slowly convinced of it, or just knows it's a great storyline. As Phil and I learned, you know, at least right after the election, he was pretty sure he lost. Mm-hmm. He was asking a very close confidant, dang, why do you think we lost? But as time has gone by, and certainly by the time we met with him in late March at Mar-a-Lago at his estate and club, he had hardened that internal narrative and he is selling it hard around the country.
So, Phil, your take on this as well. I mean, the book makes it very clear the evolution of all this, and a lot of people around the president after the election were thinking, okay, give him a little bit of space, give him a little bit of time. They understood that it was bullshit. Many of the more responsible, you know, folks just completely bailed on all of this, and yet now this has become. I mean, this has become the version, right? This has become now the litmus test, conventional wisdom in the entire Republican Party, and you're sitting there listening to this font of. This font of delusion. I don't know how else you want to describe it, but your take on this.
Yeah, Charlie, it is breathtaking to see how the big lie has evolved and become really gospel for so many Republicans, and not just you know, a select few hardcore MAGA supporters, but tens of millions of Republican voters around the country. And in turn, many, if not most, of the elected Republicans in the Congress who believe Trump's election fraud delusions, who increasingly feel like January 6th was not the horrific riot, siege, deadly event that we all witnessed on television, but rather something more minor. It's just incredible, and it speaks to the political power of Donald Trump. You know, he's no longer president, no longer in office, and yet from Mar-a-Lago, or, you know, this summer from his golf course in Bedminster, New Jersey, he remains king of Republican politics. And, you know, we saw that firsthand when we were interviewing him as congressman came to literally kiss the ring. But this power is going to continue. And it explains, I think, the news we're seeing in Washington this week, the revolt among some Republicans to the January 6th investigation mm-hmm. commission, and the reluctance among the leadership of the Republican Party to do that fulsome, thorough probe of what actually happened.
Well, you know, as you describe, and again, this is an account of the whole catastrophic final year, you know, including his COVID handling and all the people telling him he ought to wear masks and that whole amazing story. You know, some of the excerpts that from your book that have gotten the most attention deal with the fear of a military coup and Mark Milley's concerns about all of this. What's very, very clear here are the number of people who were very, very close to this White House who were shocked and appalled and alarmed by what was happening. Very few of them have spoken out publicly. Is that changing? I mean, they spoke to you. They told you these stories. But, I mean, given the moment we're in right now, where they're sitting in the Oval Office watching the implosion of this presidency, how close we came to real catastrophe, and knowing that he may be running again, explain to me the sort of the mentality of people who were part of this, saw this, were horrified by it, but are not willing to speak publicly about it. Either one of you can handle it.
You know, there were two things going on, Charlie, that Phil and I learned as we sat down with so many people with a frontline view. Remember, we interviewed more than 140 senior advisors to the president, cabinet members, political advisors, friends, the true inside the room folks. And some of them were frightened of Donald Trump, what he could do to them. They'd witnessed the way he had ruined people's reputations when they crossed him. They'd witnessed him, as one person said, ripping the face off of cabinet members who crossed him. Remember in our book, Mark Esper, the Secretary of Defense, literally gets yelled at like a child in a room full of senior officials of the government, with the president furious at him that he has said that he doesn't support invoking the Insurrection Act. The president, at the top of his voice, is roaring, you know, you undermine me, you're insubordinate, you usurped my authority, you have no right. I mean, at the top of his lungs, and a lot of other words that I can't repeat on your show. So people had seen that kind of viciousness, but also people were afraid of speaking out, because what if they were replaced by someone worse? What if a person who was not willing to be even a little bit of a bulwark replaced them? And they had witnessed that too. People ultimately agreed to speak with Phil and me because they were also thinking along the lines that you just articulated. History is not just history, it's current events. People need to understand what happened here. And once President Trump was out of office, they felt a little bit of relief to do so.
Mm-hmm. I want to get to your minute-by-minute account of January 6th, because I think this book has the most detailed answer to the question of what was going on in the White House during the attack on the Capitol. But I want to go back to the real alarm about the coup. And you have a scene in the book that is really rather, I think, sheds a lot of light and explains why they were so concerned. So Mark Milley is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he was really concerned about a coup. And he was particularly focused, you can correct me if you think I'm exaggerating this or wrong, focused on a figure named Kash Patel, a name that is not a household name in America, but was a major player at this time. And you describe how he was concerned that this Kash Patel had been summoned back to Washington in early December, and he thought that he might be named either the director of the FBI or the head of the CIA. So tell me about who Kash Patel is and why Mark Milley would have been so alarmed by this prospect, Phil.
Yeah, that's a great question. So Kash Patel, you're right, not a household name, but has been a fixture in Trump world from the beginning of this administration. He's a hardline Trump loyalist conservative who had been a staffer to Congressman Devin Nunes early in the administration and was involved in all of the intelligence matters in those early months and the leaking of information about Michael Flynn and so forth, enmeshed in that scandal. And then over the preceding couple of years, he held a number of positions, culminating in the final months of the administration in a very senior role at the Pentagon, at the Defense Department, and that alarmed Milley. And there apparently, according to our reporting, was a plot underway after the election to install Kash Patel first as the deputy director of the CIA, and then they would force out Gina Haspel, the director of the CIA, and Kash Patel would automatically ascend to be the acting director of the CIA. You know, most objective observers would argue that Kash Patel does not have qualifications be the CIA director. That's a choice the president can make. He can nominate, you know, Barron Trump if he wanted to be the CIA director, acting director. So this alarmed Milley. And the reason why is because Milley thought if Trump were to try to execute a coup to hold on to power, he would need to get control of what Milley told aides were the guys with the guns. That's the Defense Department, meaning the military, the CIA, and the FBI. And if Trump were to take out Haspel, take out Chris Wray, the FBI director, and install loyalists there, as well as a loyal yes man at the Pentagon, he could somehow gain control of a lot of the sort of armed forces, obviously, but also law enforcement forces at the federal level in the country, and apply them in a way to stay in power and overturn the election results. And so that was a very alarming moment for Milley. And he actually confronted Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, about this at the Army-Navy football game in December, because he had heard Kash Patel was being called back to Washington to be offered this job. And he said to Meadows something along the lines of, you know, what the hell are you guys doing? I'm watching this, you know, basically to give him his warning, don't screw around here. This is serious stuff. And I've got my eyes on you.
So let's talk about January 6th, because you really do have a minute-by-minute account of what happened. I think the clearest picture that I've ever gotten of what was happening both at the Capitol and at the White House. And you paint this really extraordinary picture of Mike Pence in the Capitol, not leaving, taking command, while Donald Trump is watching this on television and at least initially is absolutely delighted about it. These are his people. And they were doing what he wanted them to do. So Carol, what's new in this book about what we know about January 6th?
Well, there are some, you know, Phil and I chose to include things that shocked us, and we figured they would shock readers too. There is just a harrowing series of moments for Vice President Pence. And like him or don't like him, he, by all accounts, by friends and by foes, was absolutely stubbornly determined to stay in the Capitol, despite the fact that rioters had breached it, broken through the glass, were storming in by the hundreds and eventually the thousands.
And wanted to kill him.
they were chanting for his head. Mm-hmm. And when he was evacuated from the Senate floor with his daughter, his wife, his brother, and some of his aides, taken to a little ceremonial office not far from the Senate floor, outside his windows was the noose, the faux noose with his name on it that rioters had brought that day. As he crossed that threshold into the room, scurried by his Secret Service agents, rioters were literally charging up the stairway to that second floor landing. that he had just passed. I mean, it was a matter of seconds that prevented him from being confronted by the rioters who, again, were chanting for his death. And as he is in that hideaway, allegedly at least partially safe, his detail leader from the Secret Service comes to him three times to say, "We have got to get out of here." And each time, Pence says, "No, I'm staying. I'm not getting run off by these people. And I'm staying here to do my job to certify the election." Now, the third time that his detail leader comes to him, it's not a question anymore. It's, "I'm sorry, Mr. Vice President, we are leaving." Mm-hmm. And you've seen the video of that exit down a back stairwell. Mm-hmm. Counter-assault agents on the Secret Service detail were basically clearing a path to make sure there was no riot group on their path down to a subterranean basement. It gets worse. When they get to the basement, Pence is urged by his detail leader to get inside the armored car that he normally travels in. But Pence turns to this person who he's entrusted his life to day after day for 4 years and says, "No, I'm not getting in that car. I trust you, Tim, but other agents may drive that car out of here and I'm not leaving." Mm-hmm. So it's just, I'm not going to say profile in courage, but it is a profile in determination.
Well, also in leadership, because you describe him very sort of calmly taking control and, you know, calling up the defense secretary and, you know, telling him to get troops down to the Capitol to secure it, insisting that he's going to finish the certification of the election that night, which he did. And the contrast with Trump is interesting because I think one of the oof moments in your book is when you realize that at no point was the president of the United States engaged in exercising his power to do anything about this. I mean, Phil, is that an overstatement that he was not in touch with the Department of Defense or with anybody in that chain of command telling them to do anything?
That's exactly right, Charlie. And I would even argue it's an understatement. We saw in our reporting about January 6th for this book is that Trump completely abdicated his responsibilities as commander in chief in that moment. Here, the country was in a crisis. The Capitol was under siege, under threat. Democracy could have fallen. And the president did nothing. He watched television. He also didn't check in on the welfare of his vice president, Mike Pence, who had been so loyal to him for so many years. People were chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," and Trump never called him, never really inquired about his well-being, although he did ask 1-800, "How's Mike?" That was about it. He was just transfixed by the images on television and either unable or perhaps more likely unwilling to step forward and lead and oversee a federal military and law enforcement response to gain control of the Capitol.
You have some of these dazzling stories, you know, including Romney confronting two of his colleagues, Ron Johnson and Josh Hawley, and saying, "This is what you've caused." And of course, this now famous story about Liz Cheney brushing off Jim Jordan, who was, trying to, help her or something, take care of the female lawmakers. And she smacked his hand away and said, "Get away from me. You fucking did this. And of course, that seems very timely today, given the fact that Jim Jordan was supposed to be on that that committee, and Nancy Pelosi is basically called BS, and he's not on this. But the interaction between Liz Cheney and Jim Jordan is really kind of an extraordinary moment from that day, I thought.
Well, we definitely agreed, and we were, saddened in some respects, but also delighted to learn a fact about January 6th, what was really going on with those lawmakers. I mean, you remember that day. They were scrambling for their lives, and their staff were left behind and barricading themselves in offices as people chanted through the halls and called for their heads. In that moment with Liz Cheney, what's so striking about it is that she feels so patronized by Jim Jordan. He is sort of acting like the hero, and they're in aisles sort of hunkered down, and he says, "Oh, the ladies shouldn't be on the end of the aisles. Let's get them inside." And she is aghast, and she relays this story to General Milley much later after the fact, basically laughing, saying, you know, I told him, you know, get the heck away from me. She smacked his hand. You know, you fucking did this. Imagine that moment, right? These lawmakers are in danger, and it's not a small danger. It's mortal danger. People have come in with weapons, with batons. They've taken flagpoles to police officers' chests. They've threatened people with more bear spray, climbing gear. They themselves have gas masks on. And what's so stunning is the lawmakers know that some people have encouraged this group to walk in these doors. And they come face to face that day in the aisle with Liz Cheney staring down Jim Jordan and with Mitt Romney staring down Josh Hawley and Ron Johnson. You know, the lies that they spread along with Donald Trump were the call and response that brought that mortal danger right to their home.
Two of the things that I thought were, well, there were many, many surprising things in this book. One of them was, is your reporting that Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, considered resigning after January 6th, but was talked out of it by Mark Milley. Mike Pompeo has, you know, since, I don't know that he said anything publicly critical at all, but at least privately, he was alarmed. But also the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, threatened to resign along with all of his deputies on the night of January 6th. So why did none of these people actually resign? And tell me about Pat Cipollone. I mean, what was going on? The White House counsel threatening to resign along with all of his deputies that night. What happened?
Well, Charlie, that example was not only about the treatment of January 6th, but about the pardons that Trump was considering for his family members. And, you know, that was just a step too far for the White House counsel, and not just for Pat Cipollone, but for his team of deputies. And they were considering resigning en masse, which would have, of course, complicated the ability for the president to execute all of the pardons he wanted to do in those final days. You know, you mentioned Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State. He's a really interesting figure here because he had been a stalwart Trump loyalist, yeah, and actually wants to run for president in 2024 and would very much like to inherit that Trump coalition. And yet he was so disturbed by Trump's handling in the aftermath of the election, and especially his handling of January 6th, that he did, according to our reporting, consider resigning. We don't know how seriously he thought about it, you know, whether he you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, where exactly he fell, but it was a consideration. And he actually, between January 6th and the 20th of the inauguration, had daily morning check-in calls with General Milley and with Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, where the three of them would compare notes. They would talk about the president's state of mind. They would, you know, look across the horizon at where the trouble spots might be and what they should be concerned about, and just make sure that all three of them, you know, one at the State Department, one at the Pentagon, one inside the West Wing, were having full visibility into the dangers and the landmines ahead.
Well, let's also talk about his handling of the coronavirus, because I mean, you could certainly make a case that Donald Trump might have been reelected, might still be the president had it not been for the pandemic and his handling of the pandemic. So, Carol, his approach to masks, I think, is so illustrative of the whole issue, that he was, according to your reporting, urged by trusted folks over and over and over again, wear the mask, it will save lives, and he just wouldn't do it. So talk to me about Donald Trump and masks and the coronavirus.
You know, you've hit upon one, based on our reporting, you've hit upon one of the greatest sort of life disappointments of Robert Redfield, the CDC director. We learned that he, while really a staunch supporter of the president and a fan of his, interestingly enough, had repeatedly tried to encourage the president to wear a mask. They knew the research. He, the health secretary, the FDA, they all, the NIH director, they all knew masks worked, despite the stutter step of Tony Fauci in the beginning, mm-hmm. where he was sort of on the fence about whether or not they were that important or whether they should be recommended to the American public en masse. All of them knew masks made a difference. And they also knew the power of the presidency to make a difference. If he wore one, whether or not it benefited him, it would benefit the world. Redfield said that, said to many of his aides, I can't get him to do it. And then he started basically to go to a good friend of his, a fellow military doctor, Sean Conley, who was the White House physician and Donald Trump's doctor, and said, Sean, please, you know, please talk to your patient. If you could just get him to wear the mask, it's bad for him, no matter what, no matter how much we do to protect him, it's bad for him, but it's even worse for America. And Redfield ultimately concluded, you know, privately confiding to others that this cost American lives, thousands of them. And again, one of his biggest disappointments, he could not break through. Conley told Redfield, you know, I'm sorry, you know what it's like, Bob. You have patients who don't listen to you. I've tried. And Mark Meadows told Redfield and others, no way, he's not wearing a mask. It will hurt him too much with his base. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump said to many people, including Redfield, you know, I'm told that it just doesn't look good. It makes me look weak. People tell me it makes me look weak. And that's what he told Phil and me when we went to see him.
The cover of your book, it depicts Donald Trump tearing off the mask and that iconic moment after he came back from the hospital when he contracted the coronavirus. And he does that that photo op on the White House balcony. I mean, obviously you guys chose that, or somebody chose that to be the cover of your book as one of the representative moments, Phil. I mean, that moment really does capture the year perfectly, I think.
Well, I'm so glad to hear you say that. You know, it was a collective decision by Carol and me and our terrific publishing team at Penguin Press to choose that photo. And we thought it illustrated not only the president's resistance to science and expertise during the pandemic, but just his general defiance that became so pronounced through the year 2020 on the racial protests, on the campaign, and certainly the aftermath of the election. It just captures, you know, Trump rejecting the truth in many respects. And so, you know, we were happy with that as the cover image. And we think it can be sort of an iconic moment that illustrates so much of what was catastrophic about 2020.
So how do you explain his attitude toward vaccines right now? Because this seems to be a paradox, since the vaccines were developed under Operation Warp Speed. He could legitimately, you know, stake a claim to the vaccines, and yet his base is clearly increasingly vaccine skeptical. Obviously, except for the last few days, some Republicans apparently got the bat signal that maybe they shouldn't joke around about all of this. But so, what is his position on the vaccines? How is he straddling that line? He had the vaccine himself. Melania had the vaccine. He claims he's in favor of it. And yet, clearly, he's doing little or nothing to change the attitude of his supporters. So what is Donald Trump thinking about vaccines now?
I'm so glad you asked this, Charlie, because it shows why this is not just a history book, but a current events book, yeah. Right? This is a paradox. There is no consistency to the president and the former president's position. Donald Trump's position on this has changed quite a bit and waffled. But there is absolutely a pattern and a rhyme and a reason to this that is consistent with the way he behaves, which is, what does my base want? I will Right. feed them what they want. I mean, he said over and over again during his presidency, get this vaccine, do it now, hell or high water, I want it before the election. He couldn't have said that more times privately to his FDA director, who he was constantly pressuring, to his NIH folks, to his health secretary, Alex Azar. I mean, to the point that Defense Secretary Mark Esper was worried when he got the early reports that the vaccine in development and under trial had great efficacy. He was worried about Donald Trump learning that for fear that the president would order that people get injected before the darn thing was fully vetted and assuredly safe. By the same token, here the president tells us in the interview that he believes he's personally responsible for the vaccine. And you're right. He deserves credit for the pressure he put on the system to get it done. Now he's sowing distrust by saying he totally understands why people distrust the vaccine. And that's not helpful to public health. Here's the consistency with Donald Trump. He's doing what benefits him the most. And as he did so as president, he's putting American lives in jeopardy, again, for his own political fortune.
So, Phil, this seems to be the kind of the key to understanding Donald Trump is that even though he portrays himself as this very strong leader, that there's a really strong element of followership, that he sits there and when he watches television or listens to talk radio, he has his antenna out there. He does know what his base is thinking, what they will accept and what they won't accept. And so to that extent, rather than being the guy that tells them what to think, he often, you know, is reacting, isn't he? I mean, Donald Trump is in tune with the base and is very unwilling to have any separation between himself and his own base.
That's such a perceptive point, Charlie, because you're right. It's not that Trump is leading his base. It's that Trump is an incredible, voracious consumer of news and of social media and has an antenna for what his base wants to hear and wants to see him do. And he also, by the way, has a few advisors or had a few advisors around him who had a similar feel for the base and who could help sort of guide him. Stephen Miller was one of them, Dan Scavino, another one of them. But, you know, if you're someone like Tucker Carlson or Sean Hannity, you have extraordinary influence over Donald Trump and what he's thinking and doing, because Trump would sit in front of the television and watch their shows on Fox. And he thought that they were the spokespeople for his MAGA coalition. And, you know, if Tucker said you've got to send troops into the streets of Portland, then by golly, Trump is going to be determined to send troops into the streets of Portland to deal with the protesters. And, you know, a lot of people think that Trump could just say anything and the base would follow, but oftentimes he was afraid to try to guide the base in a direction where he didn't think they already were. And so it would have been so easy, for instance, for President Trump to have led on immigration reform and come up with some sort of a solution on immigration that would include border security, but that would also kind of end what has been a decades-long stalemate here in Washington on immigration law and policy. And yet he tried a couple of times. He got close and yet was always afraid of taking that step and actually doing it because he thought the base would revolt. And so it's really the base leading Trump.
So give me your sense. You sat down, the two of you sat down with him in Mar-a-Lago in this extraordinary scene where he's in the lobby. I can't get over the fact that he's doing these interviews in the lobby of the club and people are coming up and kissing the ring while he's talking to you and everything. And he's been doing this with all of the writers of the various books. Do you have a sense? Is he going to run again? I mean, his base clearly wants him to. He's clearly attuned to all of that. So do you have a sense? Does he even have a sense? Does he know what he wants to do, Carol?
You know, we're not in the business of speculating. Forgive me. Let me just say, we were also stunned by the way that this was in a lobby. I remember when we walked in, I said, Phil, really? Are you sure? And indeed, that's exactly where he positioned us and everyone else, largely because, you know, it appeared he wanted us to be seen. He wanted to be seen as the man people come to see, the man people want, the great oracle, right? But
I can't wait for the movie, by the way. I can't wait for the movie of all of this. As I'm reading this, I have to just tell you, I keep thinking, is this a movie? Is this going to be a miniseries? What is it going to be? Because you have to have something like that just to capture the strangeness and the bizarre nature and the drama of it all.
Yes. There are many, sorry, but, many, you know. No, that's all right. The whole scene was was riveting, including the standing ovation he received when, after our 2 hour and 45 minute interview, the standing ovation he received as he walked out onto the patio, all his club members, and the hail to the chief. It's really an interesting Elba or Brigadoon. But back to your good question, Charlie.
That's amazing.
We don't speculate about what's going to happen in the future as journalists, but what Phil and I took away from that conversation was he sounds like he's running. He talked a lot about the amazing support he has among Republicans. He speaks about himself in third person. He talks about 97%. They love Trump. And he is, again, entertaining the idea that he would run, very much so. And in a question that Phil asked him about whether or not he would commit to running with Vice President Pence as his running mate, he said he couldn't really commit to that right now. But it's a free country. And if Pence wanted to run against him, well, that's just fine. He said it kind of as if good luck with that.
Yeah. So, Phil, you have any sense?
You know, it certainly looks like if Trump had to make a decision tomorrow about running for president again, he would say yes. But, you know, he doesn't have to make that decision for another 2 years, really. And 2 years is a really long time when you're 75 years old. So who knows how his health is going to hold up? Who knows if he's going to still have the fire in the belly to get out there and run? But he certainly sees advantages in making people think he's going to run.
Sure,
because it keeps him relevant. It keeps his businesses financed. It keeps his political operation getting money in the door. And those are all good things if you're Donald Trump.
And the moment he says he's not running, all of that dynamic changes. He becomes less relevant.
Right.
The money dries up. No, the scene that you're describing down in Mar-a-Lago is so extraordinary. It is a little bit Norma Desmond, the former president sitting holding court in the lobby of the country club, and then having the standing ovation. It is a reminder how thirsty he is for adulation, how much he really, really, how needy he is for that sort of thing. But there's just something kind of bizarre and pathetic about a former president of the United States down there in Mar-a-Lago. But, you know, clearly he's living, you know, he's surrounded by people who tell him how wonderful he is. I mean, he continues to exist in that bubble, doesn't he? The bubble of adulation and people who are constantly telling him how wonderful he is and coming and kissing the ring. So, you know, he's still living his best life, isn't he?
He's almost like it's like he's still president down there and on that beautiful piece of property between the lake and the sea in Palm Beach. You know, Phil and I watched a stream of people come through for the dinner hour, and each of them sort of gleeful in their way at a sighting of Donald Trump and waving gently and carefully. Kimberly Guilfoyle standing nearby, just sort of, you know, I would guess tiptoeing towards our little a gathering to try to tell him how glad she was to see him and also beseech him to come over to her table later and meet her friends. She said, you know, they're just great supporters of Donald Trump. And he said he would. Then Laura Ingraham pops by, you know, as if it's all a nice little clam bake, and calls out to Donald Trump over the sofas, you know, you've got to tune in, Donald, tomorrow night. I'm going to take it to the doctors. She meant that on her program the next night he was going to be criticizing, of course, Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx and Dr. Redfield, who had just done a program explaining how painful it was to try to respond to the pandemic with a lot of the roadblocks that President Trump threw up against that.
Oh, my goodness. And didn't Dan Crenshaw show up too? Congressman Dan Crenshaw?
He sure did.
Oh, great. That is wonderful.
And he sucked up to Trump too. He said, "You're looking so good. What's your secret?"
Oh, man. The book is I Alone Can Fix It, Donald J. Trump's Catastrophic Final Year by Pulitzer Prize winning authors Carol Lennig and Philip Rucker. It is a riveting, riveting read. You think you know what happens, but this really is the definitive account of the year, including this minute-by-minute account of what really went on during the Capitol in the White House on January 6th. Extraordinary job. Congratulations to both of you, and thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you, Charlie.
Charlie, thank you so much.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.